From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
Donald Trump tells Reuters he thought the presidency would be easier. The health care bill he wants is stalled again, his tax plan has barely taken form, and Congress is not going to give him money for his wall. Nobody knew governing could be so hard. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Megan McArdle of Bloomberg View. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest, we might call him the floating populist if he'll agree to that, is Mickey Kaus, longtime political blogger at KausFiles.com. Welcome, everybody. Saturday is Donald Trump's 100th day in office. Actually, he'll reach 100 days on Sunday at noon, if you want to be technical about it. And he's been scrambling this week trying to generate accomplishments he can put on a first 100 days list. So he tried to get the House to finally vote on an Obamacare repeal and failed because the votes still aren't there. He announced a tax plan to great fanfare. The new plan is one page of bullet points rehashing his plan from the campaign. He demanded funding for a border wall in the bill to keep the government open and then backed down on that when Congress wouldn't give it to him. He threatened to withdraw from NAFTA and then changed his mind. Over the first 100 days, Trump has issued a lot of executive orders, but most of them do very little. They tell cabinet departments to generate reports or to scrupulously enforce laws they're already tasked with enforcing. And some of the orders that would seem to matter, especially the ban on admissions from certain Muslim-majority countries, have gotten bottled up in the courts. So despite promising a long list of actions and saying that fixing health care would be, quote, so easy last October, Trump is left with two major achievements he can plausibly claim credit for in his first 100 days. He put Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, and he's presided over an apparently significant reduction in attempts to illegally cross the U.S.-Mexican border. So, Mickey, why don't we start with you? Tell me where your assessment is of where we are nearly 100 days in. You had expressed sort of measured optimism about Trump. Does this record impress you? Are there accomplishments that I'm not giving him credit for that I should be?
No, you hit the two high points in my book, which is Gorsuch and the reduction in border crossings. I've been looking for the proper analogy for Trump, and one thing, he's like a magician, okay? He keeps a lot of balls in the air, and every time he drops one, he puts two more in the air so you don't notice that he's dropped one. But a magician sort of does that to cover something he's doing. And the only thing he's really doing that's successful is the border thing. But I think that's a real achievement. If you had told Trump voters he's going to cut illegal entries into the country by 70% to the lowest in 17 years, they would have said, okay, that's a big achievement. So I don't think it's nothing.
But so in terms of calling that an achievement, one thing we talked about a little bit last week is sort of why are fewer people coming? And to the extent that it's people are concerned that the U.S. is serious about enforcing immigration law, that can be an achievement. But if it's sort of a broader sense that the U.S. is hostile to outsiders, that Trump is hostile to Mexico and Mexicans, is it really an achievement? I mean, there are a lot of things you can do to a country to make it an unappealing place to come. A lot of them are not great for the people who are already here.
Well, it's both. But I think the Obama basically established the principle, once you get inside the country, you're home free, nothing's going to happen to you, especially if you have U.S.-born kids. Trump has violated both those rules. Once you're in the country, you can still be deported. You can even be deported if you have U.S.-born kids. I think that terrifies people in a way that says, if I get, you know, why should I go through this arduous journey if I'm not going to be home free, if I'm only going to be under threat of deportation?
Katrina, what do you make looking at these first 100 days? I was sort of interested. Ross Douthat wrote this week with a column with the headline, "It Could Be Worse." And obviously, Douthat is a conservative, but his point was basically that Trump has done less than people that expected that he might do in a Trump administration where sort of not very much gets done is a pretty good outcome compared to some others that we might imagine.
Josh, I think President Trump has shrunk. He's a smaller, more conventional president. He's like a tweeting P.T. Barnum. But, you know, he's taken sham populism into shameless plutocracy. He's not drained the swamp. He's become a swamp monster. He's waged a war on the media. He's a study in inconsistency. He's presented a skinny and laughable budget and tax reform plan. And he's offering failed trickle-down economics on steroids. A lot of attention being paid to the Trump administration's sort of feckless, reckless first 100 days. But I wanted to speak to what I think he has done. I mean, Trump has pulled millions of people into political action empowered thousands of new people to run for office. The Women's March changed everything. Airport rallies braved judges, postponed the Muslim ban, town halls, and the Freedom Caucus helped defeat Trump care. You know, tax marches threw a wrench in Trump's tax plan. So I think you're witnessing parts of a country that were not awoken, waking up. And I think the true magnitude of this resistance, which has to transform into rebuilding, can't have permanent resistance, is just starting to become clear. A full 25% of Americans, according to a recent Washington Post poll, say they plan on being more politically active this year. So Donald Trump, don't wish that he was elected by any measure, but he's playing a role in the sort of cycles of history of this country.
Megan, what's your verdict on the first 100 days?
You know, I think that the verdict is pretty much what I expected from the campaign. He hasn't got us in a nuclear war yet, which is great. But I think that when you look at what he has done, right, I mean, all throughout the campaign, I and a lot of other people were saying he's completely unprepared to actually do the job, and he doesn't seem to have any grasp at all of what the job entails, right? He would just kind of consistently refuse to bone up on policy, hire people who could come up with policies, and he would just sort of throw out these half-baked ideas and then move on from without ever fleshing out policy. But policy is detail. It's not that taxes should be lower or we should care for people more, right? Those are not policies. Those are nice goals. Policy is about spelling out all of these like mind-numbing profusion of rules that have to be made in order to get government employees to do what you want. And he's never gotten to that point. He's never wanted to brief himself on the complexities of any of these issues. And you've seen this time and time again, right? He sort of threw out the executive orders on immigration. And he made, after making a lot of comments that were going to make it hard to get those orders through the court. I'm not sure I agree with the courts for striking down some of these executive orders on the basis of earlier statements. I'm not sure how I feel about that legally, but that is realistically what happened. He made a lot of bad remarks about judges who, of course, don't like him now. And more broadly, if you look at things like the healthcare plan, right? I mean, this was just a catastrophe. The administration just wanted to do it quickly. What did they want to do? They wanted it to be awesome because that's what Donald Trump said it was going to be on the campaign trail. And what we have ended up with in is a shambles where they're continually just trying to do something for the sake of doing something. There's no overseeing architecture. And, you know, you can kind of blame Congress for this. They've been talking about repealing Obamacare for a long time. They should have brought themselves much closer to consensus than they have, in fact, turned out to be. That said, the administration has always had to provide leadership on these issues. The administration on a big campaign platform plank like this is the one that comes out and says, OK, this is the architecture we want. You guys negotiate the details. We understand that it's going to change over time. But here's where we want you to get us to. And now let's work with you on getting there. The administration doesn't care about getting anywhere. The administration just cares about being able to say they passed something that was awesome.
But the problem with healthcare was that he farmed it out to Paul Ryan and that healthcare then became the prelude to the tax bill. In other words, he took $150, $300 billion out of healthcare to save it for the tax bill, and you can't do healthcare if you're going to take that much money out of the system.
That's true, but there's the reason that he did that is that, again, he had promised this huge, completely unrealistic tax cut. And look, I'm a libertarian. I would like a smaller government. But if you're going to have a smaller government, you got to start with by knowing what you're going to cut.
The irony is that Obamacare, which was not very popular, has suddenly become quite popular. And, you know, I think this administration is, such as it is worried because its budget, the health care bill they're looking at, tax reform, all disproportionately hurt the very supporters of this administration. I don't know how they square that. I do think we've seen resilience in the system. I think we've seen a system of checks and balances rear up. I think we've seen the courts act as they should. The media, to a large extent, has stepped up its game, though sometimes I will say I think the it stepped up its game. And I think the people, as I was talking about earlier in terms of, quote, the resistance has stepped up its game. So it's a country under stress. It's a test of our nation. But there's a resilience and a stamina that I think is very important to mark on this 100th day.
Mickey, Katrina makes that point about the people who would be negatively impacted by Obamacare repeal. You have some states that went very strongly for Donald Trump, like West Virginia, which have an enormous penetration for Medicaid as it was expanded under Obamacare. And the thing I'm trying to understand is, even if you buy the idea that immigration is a significant driver of depressed wages in the United States, and you think that Donald Trump's agenda on that will, at the margin, help some of these people who voted for him economically, all this countervailing stuff, if you take away health benefits that they rely on, if you give a huge unfunded tax cut to rich people that is likely to ultimately have to come out of government programs that people care about in the long run, isn't that ultimately a bad deal on net for his supporters?
It may be a close question if those things happen. But so far, he hasn't repealed Obamacare, and he hasn't achieved a tax
plan.
But he has cut immigration. And you read stories today in the paper. American employers are going to have to take the drastic measure of recruiting a domestic workforce. Well, that's going to be good for workers when employers decide to hire Americans. So that's happening now. The other things are sort of his magician's balls in the air that he'll probably never get through.
So if your view is basically that he's more likely to succeed in the good things that he wants to do than the bad things, is that luck? Is that systematic? How can you be confident that that holds?
I can't be. and his whole decision-making process, where he suddenly demands a border wall and then immediately backs down, is bizarre, and I can't quite explain it.
Josh, I think another area where Trump has betrayed his supporters is, I don't think this country's any war. I think it is weary of war. And Donald Trump kind of took a stick to the beehive of a bipartisan foreign policy establishment and spoke more about ending nation building, ending regime change, building more at home, engaging the world in different ways. And that's out the window. I mean, whether it makes his ego feel good or what, but he certainly launched those strikes, and he's talking about military action against North Korea, which is madness. So it's, again, another area where you have heard rumblings from the very people who supported him on this front.
In retrospect, doesn't the strike in Syria seem small? I mean, he hasn't adopted McMaster's big plan to send in 20,000 American troops. He seemed to back off.
Yeah,
I think it's too early to tell. But you do see around Donald Trump people who, you know, want to Iran in the crosshairs, want to dismantle a very good nuclear deal, and who, you know, whose first response, it seems, is more military action than hard thinking and political resolution of crises.
I think the counter theory to that is that wars are complicated and difficult to launch, and as with the tax plan and the health care plan and other things, Trump will tend to gravitate toward the simple, easy things rather than the hard, complicated things, both hard substantively and hard politically. And so my hope is that would tend to mean that military actions would tend to be limited to the sort of pinprick strikes that we saw in Syria. What do we make, though, about his comments this week about North Korea, where he seems to have been all over the map, and particularly all of a sudden seeming to have gotten harsh with South Korea and complaining that they ought to pay for this missile defense system we're going to give them, and that their trade deal is really bad, and now in the middle of all of this geopolitical crisis in the Korean Peninsula, we need to renegotiate our free trade agreement with Korea? It just all seemed very non-strategic, very scattershot to me.
You know, I think that that's completely right. And I think it goes back to the fact that Donald Trump is not doing the normal things that a president does. He didn't do them on the campaign in terms of getting his ducks in a row, at least having advisors, getting some kind of strategic framework. Now, look, does that strategic framework actually survive contact with reality? No, I don't think that Obama's foreign policy was what he expected on the campaign trail. And honestly, I think that some of the worst parts of his foreign policy were the parts that looked the most like what he had sketched out on the campaign trail. But that said, they at least sort of have some familiarity with the issues and some idea of where they want to go and their kind of philosophy about what they want to do in the world. And that conveys a credible message to other people that other nations now know what to expect. Donald Trump didn't do those briefings. I think he really still hasn't. And that's why you see things like the softwood lumber thing, where he had, I guess, heard about the old softwood lumber dispute with Canada, and then he just starts threatening to pull out a NAFTA. Well, you know, the softwood lumber dispute itself is actually, like, that was actually proceeded completely normally. This is what happens. We've been arguing about this for 30 years. We threaten them with tariffs. Maybe we enact them. They get sued. And then we come to some new agreement, and then it's quiet for 8 or 10 years, and it all starts over again. But the NAFTA remarks were crazy. easy. And this is a similar thing where he seems to go into an issue like North Korea, which is frankly not an issue that anyone has been able to solve because it's incredibly difficult unless we're willing to go in and invade North Korea, which thank God we aren't. But he just seems to have randomly grabbed the South Korea isn't paying enough. Maybe we'll cancel their trade deal. I mean, this is and it's actually the same move he tried to pull on Canada earlier in the week. These are
I think Megan's right. I think it's the last person who spoke to him sometimes. That's the foreign policy. But I do think there's a broader issue here. Sometimes it seems like our media and even our foreign policy class live in an eternal present with each new crisis presented as treated as sui generis. I mean, a bipartisan consensus has emerged based on the false assumption that all previous attempts to rein in the North Koreans' nuclear program have failed. But that's not the case. Clinton, we talked about this, got it to freeze plutonium production for 8 years. Bush administration ignored agreements and set out to destroy the 94 freeze. I think the strategic patience of the Obama administration had its limits, but now we have a kind of impatient petulance, which, as Megan said, I mean, is partly based on a failure to do tough thinking, but also based on an unwillingness to jumpstart a diplomatic initiative. And I think the looming South Korean elections are troubling to the United States administration at this point, because you do have a kind of progressive left candidate who wants to find a different approach to North Korea, which the United States isn't that keen to adopt.
I need to take a quick break, but we will come back and talk more about healthcare and some of the other first 100 days issues. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation. On the right is Megan McArdle of Bloomberg View. And Mickey Kouse, longtime political blogger at KouseFiles.com, is also with us. There were supposed to be two big pieces of policy news this week. One was this revised health care bill that they were maybe going to try to take a vote on. And the other was a new tax plan from Donald Trump. And of course, both of these ended up being sort of underwhelming. The proposed revision in the health care bill was to further gut the insurance regulations that were created in Obamacare. These changes would have allowed insurers to charge people a lot more if they had pre-existing conditions. It would have said insurers have to sell to you even if you have a pre-existing condition. They can charge you $10 million if they want, but they have to offer you something at some price. It also would have allowed insurers to sell plans that omit key benefits. You could have a plan that doesn't cover prescription drugs, even a plan that doesn't cover hospital visits. These changes seem to have won over about a dozen conservative Republicans in the House who wouldn't vote for the last version of the bill because they thought it regulated insurance too much. But it seems to have appalled some Republican moderates, and House leadership did not bring the bill up for a vote within Trump's first 100 days, as the president seemed to really want them to do, because they didn't have enough votes to pass it. Of course, the tax plan was basically just a list of bullet points, very similar to the fairly vague tax plan that Donald Trump had as a candidate. Megan, you were very critical of the last iteration of the health care bill. Is this version an improvement in your libertarian view in that it takes out some more of the regulations?
Look, I opposed Obamacare. I continue to think it was a bad idea. I think it basically set up the American healthcare system, which was already structurally completely crazy because of all of the like nine different systems that we had overlapping. But the problem, the part of the reason that Obamacare is so bad is that they went in with a mindset of we can't touch anything that's already existing. And then you come in, you do Obamacare, and then the individual market, we're still arguing about whether there might be a death spiral, whether there is a death spiral. It has certainly caused a lot of problems in the individual market, precisely because of the stuff that they couldn't touch before. And the Republicans have come forward. They spent years just promising that they were going to overturn it without getting to the consensus they needed to. And then, you know, you go in and you say, I can't touch anything that's there, including not all of the stuff in Obamacare that's not working. This is basically what you end up with. They don't want to touch the pre-existing conditions rule, which is basically the rule that says, you know, you cannot refuse to sell someone insurance. And so they keep trying to play around at the edges with something that will not touch this one thing that's super popular. And as long as you don't touch that, you are stuck with kind of basically the architecture that they have. They don't want to confront that. And what they've ended up with now is the Freedom Caucus, who really needs to go back to their districts and say, look, I did something on healthcare. I've been promising it for 6 years. We've got Congress and the White House, and we're going to do it. But then you have the moderates who actually, at this point, given the impossibility of doing anything rational, they would just rather not touch it. Politically, for them, there is no rational reason for them to do so. The only thing they can do is get themselves in a world of hurt, in part because, given the problems that there are in Obamacare right now, if the Republican Party touches it, they own it 100%. Now, if they don't touch it, they still own quite a bit of it. You know, if it fails, they're going to own part of it. But Obama's going to own a lot of that. And liberals can complain that, like, Republicans weren't doing enough. But the Obama administration had to go to illegal lengths to support this bill. This is not like it was all just in great shape and then the Republicans screwed it up. The fact is they passed a bill that didn't work. And then they expected Republicans, having told them elections have consequences and having not made any attempt to do serious negotiation that was not, hey, would you like to, like, pick the red bow that we're going to put on the top of the bill at the signing ceremony. And then they expected Republicans to spend a lot of political capital fixing their unpopular bill. That was always insane. Democrats own the responsibility for that. But the minute that Republicans change it, then that it's their program.
Mickey, I know that you said that you don't think the president's ultimately going to do anything on this, but as Megan notes, there are significant problems with the system as it exists. Given that there are problems with the way it is now and that the things that he has talked about doing are both very unpopular and bad for his voter base, what would you have the president do here?
I keep waiting for him to pivot against Paul Ryan and say, look, Paul Ryan, you failed, and now we're going to try to work a deal with the Democrats. And the obvious big move he could make, it wouldn't solve all the problems of Obamacare, is to lower the Medicare age. So you take some of the older, sicker people out of the pool, makes it cheaper for everyone. Wildly popular among Democrats. It would be even more popular among voters, and I think it would be irresistible.
It would cost a lot of money to put a lot of people on Medicare.
You know, I think Mickey's right. I mean, I don't see it in reality, but Trump would be wise to do that because, again, just as with the budget and taxes, the way this is moving is going to disproportionately shaft his supporters. And lowering the Medicare age is something Senator Merkley has put out there. Of Oregon, and I think there's very good support for it, and it would meet the test in a lot of the communities which supported Trump. But we're not looking at rational actors here. I mean, what Megan just issued was an indictment of a party which had been out of power, promising its supporters something, which it comes in to power, controls all the levers of power, and miserably fails, shows that it's incapable of governing. It's capable of destroying. It's capable of dismantling that administrative state, of dismantling health care, but not providing people a humane and level-headed, common-sense bill that would address problems in this country that are simply going to fester and be unsustainable.
I think that part of the problem here is that the president literally doesn't understand that what he's promised is impossible. And this was another thing that was in these interviews this week. The Washington Examiner asked him, you know, you want to lower premiums. And the president says yes. And you want to maintain coverage levels. And he says yes. And you want the government to spend less. And he says yes. And the interviewer says, well, some of those things are a little bit in tension with each other, aren't they? And the president goes, well, no, I don't think so. So I think, you know, even there's one problem, which is that the trade-offs are politically unappealing, and it's not fun to have to tell people who's going to have to pay more or who's going to get the short end of any sort of reform. But I think the president doesn't even realize that there are trade-offs that he's hiding. He literally doesn't understand that the trade-offs exist.
Look, let's be fair. When Obama was selling Obamacare, there were suddenly no trade-offs. Premiums were going to drop $2,500 for an average family. We were going to expand coverage. We were going to pay for it by getting rid of unnecessary amputations. I mean, this is actually...
Donald Trump is now president. And if he can't bring to bear his brilliant, transactional, huge style on this, you know, as Mickey well says, he passed it off to Paul Ryan. And now he wants it back, or he doesn't know what to do with it. It's a football. It's a hot football. And I think if these are all interlinked, sort of health care, tax bill, budget, we got a big mess on our hands, and a country that deserves a better chance is going to be dismantled, and the civilizing advances, forget the idea that health care is a human right, which I believe, civilizing advances of this country are going to be rolled back, and it's going to be a generational struggle to rebuild a country that deserves a hell of a lot better.
Mickey, what do you make of this tax plan that focuses so heavily on cutting corporate taxes, business taxes, that pass through to wealthy individuals who own businesses? Why is your populist guy leading with this?
Because he thinks there is a big bonus to be gotten if you repatriate all this corporate money that's overseas. And tax reform is generally a good thing if you can lower rates and stop people spending time and energy looking for loopholes They can focus their investment on the things where the maximum, where there's the maximum payoff, and we haven't had a tax reform since 86. So I don't think it's crazy. There's nothing very appealing to voters in this bill except the vague promise that it's going to make more jobs. The individual side of it doesn't seem to be much. He's lowering the top rate 4%. I tend to, and tax reform is very, very hard. I see this mainly as a jobs bill for lobbyists in Washington. I mean, when you went to the conventions, all the lobbyists were saying, well, Trump's going to sign, we're going to have tax reform. And I thought they were ideologically committed to tax reform. In fact, tax reform was the employment bill because when there's a tax reform on the agenda, every lobbyist in Washington gets work.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Megan McArdle, what's your rant?
A parade has been shut down in Oregon because a group of Antifas, we think, sent a note to the parade organizers saying, you've allowed these fascists to participate. Unless you get rid of them, we will be taking to the streets and you know what we can do. The fascist group that they were protesting against? The Republican Party of Multnomah County. Now, we have gotten to a point in this country where people are unable to talk rationally about their opponents and where violence is becoming an antidote to speech. If we don't band together to stop this now, we are looking at some very troubling political times to come.
Mickey Kaus.
Where are the jackboots? Remember before the election and as Trump was taking office, there were all these predictions that Trump was like Hitler, Trump was an autocrat, if he wasn't quite like Hitler. As Walter Russell Mead pointed out recently, these people made buffoons of themselves. They were completely wrong. Will they admit error? No. They're declaring victory. They're saying, well, the only reason Trump doesn't seem to be being a fascist is we stopped him. Yes, all credit to us. Well, if Trump was that easily stopped, maybe he wasn't a fascist at all.
Katrina Vandenhoevel.
We've heard a lot about the Trump administration's war on the media, but there's another war on the media that's under the radar you need to know about. The Trump administration's FCC has put out a proposal to kill net neutrality. That may sound unsexy, but net neutrality is essential to protecting our free and open internet, which has been crucial to today's fights for civil rights and equality. If you care about an open internet, about media democracy, come to thenation.com this Monday and sign a petition, which we, with other media democracy groups, will present to the FCC on May 18th. Keep our internet open and free.
For my rant, Barack Obama will receive a $400,000 speaking fee later this year from the investment bank Cantor Fitzgerald. The defense of this that has been going around is variations on everybody does it, which isn't quite true. The tradition of post-presidential cash outs is actually pretty new, basically going back to Ronald Reagan in 1990, and he was roundly criticized for it at the time. The problem with these is that if presidents are expected to go around collecting large sums of money from the industries that they make policy about as president, people will reasonably be concerned that they will go easy on those industries while they are in office. And indeed, this practice can even affect people on an unconscious level as they make policy decisions. The best way to demonstrate to the public that policy is being made in the public interest, especially with regard to industries like banking where policy errors can do grave damage to the global economy, is to have a strong norm against taking payments like these. It would be great if Barack Obama, who's likely to be active in our politics for 30 years to come, would decline fees of this nature. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Megan McArdle, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and Mickey Kaus. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Berskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.